Miss Golightly kept her promise to Mr. Yuniashi. Or I assume she did not ring his bell again, for in the next day she started ringing mine. Sometimes at 2 in the morning, 3 and 4. She had no qualms at what hour she got me out of bed to push the buzzer that released the downstairs door. As I had few friends and none who would come round so late, I always knew it was her. But on the first occasions of its happening, I went to my door half expecting bad news, a telegram, and Miss Golightly would call up, "Sorry, darling, I forgot my key." Of course, we'd never met. Though actually, on the stairs, in the street, we often came face to face. But she seemed not quite to see me. She was never without dark glasses, and she was always well-groomed. One might have thought of her a photographer's model, perhaps a young actress, except that it was obvious, judging from her hours, she hadn't time to be either. Now and then I ran across her outside our neighborhood. Once a visiting relative took me to Club 21, and there at a superior table, surrounded by 4 men, was Miss Golightly, idly, publicly combing her hair, and her expression, an unrealized yawn, put, by example, a dampener on the excitement I felt over dining at so swanky a place. Another night, deep in the summer, the heat of my room sent me out into the streets. I walked down 3rd Avenue to 51st Street, where there was an antique store, with an object in its window I admired, a palace of a birdcage, a mosque of minarets and bamboo rooms yearning to be filled with talkative parrots. But the price was $350. On the way home, I noticed a cab driver crowd gathered in front of P.J. Clark's saloon, apparently attracted there by a happy group of whiskey-eyed Australian Army officers baritoning Waltzing Matilda. As they sang, they took turns spin-dancing a girl over the cobbles, and the girl, Miss Golightly, to be sure, floated round in their arms light as a scarf. But if Miss Golightly remained unconscious of my existence, except as a doorbell convenience, I became rather an authority on hers. I discovered, from observing the trash basket outside her door, that her regular reading consisted of tabloids and travel folders and astrological charts, that she smoked an esoteric cigarette called Picayunes, survived on cottage cheese and Melba toast, that her very colored hair was somewhat self-induced, and that she received V-letters by the bale. They were always torn into strips like bookmarks. I used occasionally to pluck myself a bookmark in passing. Remember and miss you and rain and please write and damn and goddamn were the words that recurred most often on these slips. Those and lonesome and love. Also, she had a cat, and she played the guitar. On days when the sun was strong, she would wash her hair and, together with the cat, a red tiger-striped Tom, sit out on the fire escape thumbing a guitar while her hair dried. She played very well, and sometimes sang, too. She knew all the show hits, Cole Porter and Kurt Vile. Especially she liked the songs from Oklahoma, which were new that summer and everywhere. But there were moments when she played songs that made you wonder where she learned them, where indeed she came from. One went, "Don't want to sleep, don't want to die, just want to go traveling through the pastures of the sky." And this one seemed to gratify her the most, for often she continued long after her hair had dried, after the sun had gone and there were lighted windows in the dusk. But our acquaintance did not make headway until September, an evening with the first ripple chills of autumn running through it. I'd been to a movie, come home, and gone to bed with a bourbon nightcap and the newest Simenon. So much my idea of comfort that I couldn't understand a sense of unease that multiplied until I could hear my heart beating. It was a feeling I'd read about, written about, but never before experienced. The feeling of being watched. Then, an abrupt rapping at the window, a glimpse of ghostly gray. I spilled the bourbon. It was some little while before I could bring myself to open the window and ask Miss Golightly what she wanted.
"I've got the most terrifying man downstairs," she said, stepping off the fire escape into the room. "I mean, he's sweet when he isn't drunk, but let him start lapping up the vino and, oh, God, kill beast. If there's one thing I loathe, it's men who bite."
She loosened the gray flannel robe off her shoulder to show me evidence of what happens if a man bites. The robe was all she was wearing.
"I'm sorry if I frightened you. I think he thinks I'm in the bathroom. Not that I give a damn what he thinks. The hell with him. He'll get tired. He'll go to sleep. My God, he should. 8 martinis before dinner and enough wine to wash an elephant. Listen, you can throw me out if you want to, but that fire escape was damned icy. And you look so cozy. Like my brother Fred. Oh, we used to sleep 4 in a bed, and he was the only one that ever let me hug him on a cold night. By the way, do you mind if I call you Fred?"
She paused, staring at me. I'd never seen her before not wearing dark glasses, and it was obvious now that they were prescription lenses, for without them, her eyes had an assessing squint like a jeweler's. They were large eyes, a little blue, a little green, dotted with bits of brown, very colored like her hair, and like her hair, it gave out a lively, warm light.
"I suppose you think I'm very brazen or trefou or something."
"Not at all." She seemed disappointed.
"Yes, you do. Everybody does. I don't mind. It's useful."
She sat down on one of the rickety red velvet chairs, curved her legs underneath her, and glanced around the room.
"How do you bear it? It's a chamber of horrors."
"Oh, you get used to anything," I said, annoyed with myself, for actually, I was proud of the place.
"I don't. I'll never get used to anything. Anybody that does, they might as well be dead. What do you do here all day?"
I motioned toward the table with books and paper. "Write things?"
"I thought writers were quite old. Of course, Sir Royan isn't old. I met him at a party, and really, he isn't old at all. In fact," she mused, "if he'd give himself a closer shave... By the way, is Hemingway old?"
"In his 40s, I should think."
"That's not bad. I can't get excited by a man until he's 42. I know this idiot girl who keeps telling me I ought to go to a head shrinker. She says I have a father complex, which is so much merde. I simply trained myself to like older men, and it was the smartest thing I ever did. Tell me, are you a real writer?"
"It depends what you mean by real."
"Well, darling, does anybody buy what you write?"
"Not yet."
"I'm going to help you," she said. "I can, too. Think of all the people I know people. I'm going to help you because you look like my brother Fred, only smaller. I haven't seen him since I was 14. That's when I left home, and he was already 6'2". My other brothers are more your size, runts. It was the peanut butter that made Fred so tall. Everybody thought it was Dotty, the way he gorged himself on peanut butter, but he wasn't Dotty, just sweet and vague and terribly slow. Poor Fred. I wonder if the army's generous with their peanut butter. Which reminds me, I'm starving."
I pointed to a bowl of apples. At the same time, asked her how and why she'd left home so young. She looked at me blankly and rubbed her nose as though it tickled. A gesture I came to recognize as a signal that one was trespassing. She took a bite of an apple and said,
"Tell me something you've written, The story part."
"That's one of the troubles. They're not the kind of stories you can tell."
"Too dirty?"
"Maybe I'll let you read one sometime."
"Whiskey and apples go together. Fix me a drink, darling. Then you can read me a story yourself."
Very few authors, especially the unpublished, can resist an invitation to read aloud. I made us both a drink, and settling in a chair opposite, began to read to her. It was a new story I'd finished it the day before, and that inevitable sense of shortcoming had not had time to develop. It was about two women who share a house, schoolteachers, one of whom, when the other becomes engaged, spreads with anonymous notes a scandal that prevents the marriage. As I read, each glimpse I stole of Holly made my heart contract. She fidgeted. She picked apart the butts in an ashtray. She mooned over her fingernails as though longing for file. Worse, when I did seem to have her interest, there was actually a telltale frost over her eyes, as if she were wondering whether to buy a pair of shoes she'd seen in some window.
"Is that the end?"
she asked, waking up.
"Of course, I like dykes themselves. They don't scare me a bit. But stories about dykes bore the bejesus out of me." "Well, really, darling," she said, because I was clearly puzzled. "If it's not about a couple of old bull dykes, what the hell is it about?"
But I was in no mood to compound the mistake of having read the story with the further embarrassment of explaining it.
"Incidentally," she said, "do you happen to know any nice lesbians? I'm looking for a roommate." "Well, don't laugh. Dykes are wonderful homemakers. They love to do all the work. You never have to bother about brooms and defrosting and sending out laundry. I had a roommate in Hollywood. She played in westerns. They called her the Lone Ranger. But I'll say this for her. She was better than a man around the house. Of course, people couldn't help but think I must be a bit of a dyke myself. And of course I am. Well, everyone is. A bit. So what? That never discouraged a man yet. In fact, it seems to goad them on. That's not true." She was staring at an alarm clock on the table. "It can't be 4:30. The window was turning blue. A sunrise breeze banded the curtains. "What is today?"
"Thursday."
"Thursday?"
She stood up.
"My God," she said, and sat down again with a moan. "It's too gruesome."
I was tired enough not to be curious. I lay down on the bed and closed my eyes. Still, it was irresistible. What's gruesome about Thursday?
"Nothing, except that I can never remember when it's coming. You see, on Thursdays I have to catch the 8:45. They're so particular about visiting hours. So if you're there by 10, that gives you an hour before the poor men eat lunch. Think of it, lunch at 11. I've got to stay awake," she said,
punching her cheeks until the roses came.
"There isn't time to sleep. I'd look consumptive. I'd sag like a tenement, and that wouldn't be fair. A girl can't go to Sing Sing with a green face."
"I suppose not." The anger I felt at her over my story was ebbing. She absorbed me again.
"All the visitors do make an effort to look their best, and, oh, it's sweet as hell. The way the women wear their prettiest everything, I love them for it. I love the kids, too, especially the colored ones. It should be sad seeing the kids there, but it isn't. They have ribbons in their hair and lots of shine on their shoes, and, oh, you think there's going to be ice cream. And sometimes that's what it's like in the visitors' room, a party. They're so happy to see each other. It's different afterwards. I see them on the train. They sit so quiet watching the river go by."
She stretched a strand of her hair to the corner of her mouth and nibbled it thoughtfully.
"I'm keeping you awake. Go to sleep."
"Please. I'm interested."
"I know you are. That's why I want you to go to sleep. Because if I keep on, I'll tell you about Sally. I'm not sure if that would be quite cricket."